In our culture, we have become very familiar with what is referred to as the American Dream. Historians trace the first use of that phrase back to a book that was written in 1931 by a man named James Truslow Adams in his work entitled The Epic of America. Adams contended that because of this dream, quote, each man and woman shall be able to attain to the fullest stature of which they are innately capable and be recognized by others for what they are, unquote. In other words, there is an inherent assumption in the American dream regarding our ability to make something of ourselves. And we in our culture often hear it referred to that, you know, in America you can do whatever you set your mind to. You can be whatever you want to be. You can become president of the United States. You can make something of yourself. In regard to the American dream, the greatest asset, therefore, becomes our own ability. And thus, the American dream really is a very man-centered concept. And out of that concept comes a couple of lines of thinking, both of which are flawed. The first has to do with the belief that because our success is contingent totally upon our effort, that we are motivated to work even harder. For our ancestors, back before the days of electricity, their lives were lived according to the natural rhythm of the day. When the sun was up, they worked. When evening came and the sun began to go down, life slowed and eventually came to a complete halt, very early as a bedtime. That lifestyle obviously stands in marked contrast to our own, where artificial light is available to us 24 hours a day. Darkness never has to fall upon us, and thus we can work late into the evening. We can even work through the entire night, as some of you do. Cell phones and internet enable us to be accessible 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. And even worse, the mere capacity for work has, for many in our culture, become a source of pride, that we believe that our success is not just in the fact that we work hard, but that we work harder and we work longer than other people. That's why we are so successful. And so compulsive work habits are admired and they are rewarded in our culture. And as a result, people in living out the American dream are not compelled to trust God to work in their lives, but rather to trust in their own ability to arrange and to rearrange their lives according to their own efforts. And there's a second element that's flawed as well, and that is with the advance of evolution and humanism, we have come to believe that all of life springs from us. And you will sometimes hear couples, whether it's in a movie or on a television show, they will often utter the phrase at the birth of a child, "We made this." While it's certainly true that the mom and the dad were involved in the process, human life in reality is much, much bigger than just the two of them, isn't it? And that brings us to our next song for the road, Psalm 127, and the overarching theme of this particular song is a dependence upon God in realms of everyday life. It is the eighth of the 15 songs that make up the group that we know as the Songs of Ascent. And thus, as the eighth song, it is central in the collection. You'll notice that the superscription of Psalm 127 reads that it is of Solomon, which is very fitting because in this psalm, it fits well into a category known as the wisdom psalms. In fact, in just its five brief verses, we find three different types of wisdom sayings. There is counsel, for example, on everyday conduct that is referred to as a truth saying or a proverb in verse 1. There is a comparison piece of wisdom that's made in verse 4. And then there is a beatitude that we find in verse 5. And as we read through this chapter, you'll see that it has very much the feel of other works of Solomon, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, for example. And as is the case with much of the wisdom literature in the Bible, the implication of it is that by heeding the instruction that is given to us in these pieces of wisdom, that we are enabled to discover life, real life. That here are timeless truths in regard to a futility of life lived without God. That without His involvement, without His blessing, all human effort, all human precaution is vain. You'll notice that it divides easily into two separate sections, verses 1 and 2, verses 3 through 5. Each of those two sections consists of two four-line poems. And each one of those poems begins with a reference to God's involvement in human life, and it concludes with a statement about the implications of that claim. As Solomon reflects on the question of true success in daily life, he contends that life can only be rightly understood and rightly lived in light of the Lord's involvement. In particular, he's going to address two domestic enterprises, work and family. This is not so much a song for a Lord's Day assembly, all dressed in our Sunday best. This is a song that's much more equipped for Monday through Saturday. It's a song of divine providence, the hidden actions of God that lie behind the domestic activities that we engage in through the course of a normal week. It's about builders building and laborers laboring and guards guarding. It's about getting up early and working late. It's about couples with young kids who can't remember the last full night of sleep that they had. It's the stuff of real life. It's the stuff of the daily grind. And even though there is nothing in the psalm itself that would suggest a pilgrimage, and that, of course, is the songs of ascent as they sang them as they made their way to one of Israel's great feasts in the city of Jerusalem. It may dovetail well into that effort. As they would travel a great distance, they would expend much effort, they would overcome numerous obstacles, and maybe as they journey, there was this tendency to congratulate one another on the success of their journey, that they became proud in regard to their achievement, or they began to trade stories about their experience, and as they recounted previous trips, they would begin to make comparisons about who had made the longest trip, and who had made the fastest trip, and who had brought the most people to the feast in their caravan, and who had come to the feast the most times. And in the midst of those kinds of discussions, someone might begin to sing this song and reassert the proper perspective, unless the Lord builds. It is not their pilgrimage and it's not their effort that's at the center. It's God alone who is at the center. That no matter how these pilgrims on Jerusalem may have struggled to arrive at the feast, no matter what heroic things may have taken place as they traveled along the way, it is a song that stresses perspective. That our efforts are at the periphery. And it's God's work that is at the center. While it's true that the way that we look at things doesn't necessarily change the way that they actually are, perspective does change the approach and the attitude that we bring to the table. And thus it alters the way that we actually live life. And so this song for the road describes for us the triangular relationship between God, human beings, and day-to-day life. And it exhorts us to choose to see life through an important lens, and that is through the lens of the eyes of God. That to attempt to live life apart from God's involvement is to run the risk of engaging in activities that in the end are not only going to prove unsuccessful, but utterly meaningless. With that background, let's read beginning in verse 1. Psalm 127, verse 1. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors. For he gives to his beloved even in his sleep. Behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. As I mentioned earlier, he first of all begins with seeing through the eyes of God in regard to our work. You'll notice that that first verse contains two conditional clauses that are hardwired into the structure of it. Solomon says that unless this takes place here, that over there will never happen. But it's conditioned upon something that's very different than what most people might think. There are a lot of ways of building the house. There's a lot of ways that can be taken. Some, because it's written by Solomon, think that he has in mind the building of the temple. But it is also can be used to describe the actual building of a literal house. It can describe building a dynasty. We see references in the Old Testament to the house of David, to building a family. And in Ruth chapter 4 and verse 11, we see this same term used to describe the building of a nation. Now, most people would tell you that they believe that any kind of effective building is ultimately conditional. But it is conditional in their minds upon their actions and not upon God's. And so they operate on the basis that if I do A, B, C, and D, if I follow the rules, if I adhere to the right work ethic, if I put forth maximum effort, then I can flourish. But the psalmist says, unless the Lord is the one who's doing the building, those who labor, labor in vain. The word labor there, by the way, is a word in the Hebrew that emphasizes hard work, strenuous effort, great energy. The psalmist, in essence, says, you go out and you work your fingers to the bone, but you know what you get? Bony fingers. I'm paraphrasing. Got to know the Hebrew to get that out of there. Obviously, Solomon is not saying don't work. He's not saying here that good ideas and a strong work ethic and diligent effort, all of those things are unimportant. That's not what he's saying. What he is saying is that even with your best effort, even with your hardest work, you are going to end up utterly frustrated if God is not the primary one involved in the building. That if he is not the primary cause of it, then your work and your labor will have very little, if any, impact. One of the greatest projects in the ancient world ended up in utter disaster. And yet, they had unexcelled organization. They had perfect communication. They had enormous enthusiasm. And yet, the Tower of Babel shattered civilization and garbled communication. Mere effort, even if the effort is towards something religious. You remember the builders of the Tower of Babel, they were trying to reach toward the heaven. That by itself doesn't produce effective results. In Western culture, we have deified human effort, and thus we sort of pick up right where the Tower of Babel has left off. We boast about what our technology enables us to do. We believe that we can somehow exercise control over the entire planet and therefore exercise control over our existence. On the other hand, Eastern culture tends to manifest a deep-rooted pessimism toward human effort. That work is tainted with selfishness and pride, and therefore the solution is don't work at all. Paul dealt with that kind of a mentality in Thessalonica in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. Buddha becomes a marvelous example of that line of thinking. You've got an overweight guy who's sitting cross-legged, contemplating his navel. He's motionless, he's quiet, because after all trouble comes because you're doing too much. And therefore the answer is you don't do anything at all. The answer of discovering life is you do as little as possible. You have the goal of withdrawing absolutely and finally from action and thought and passion. Solomon says the way to work effectively in life is not from sheer activity, and it's certainly not from pure passivity. He's not saying here, hey, God's got a great work for you to do, but it's all on you to do it. Nor is he saying God has done everything. You don't have to worry about doing anything on your own. The builder still matters, but it's the perspective of the builder that matters. There were some home builders. They drove to a nearby lumber yard, and one of them walked into the office and he told the clerk, he says, I need some 4x2s. And the clerk looked at him and said, do you mean 2x4s? And he said, well, let me go check. He walked out the door. He came back and he said, yeah, I meant 2x4s. And the clerk says, well, how long do you need them? And the man paused and he says, I better go check. He walked out. He returned a few minutes later. He said, we're going to need him for a long time because we're building a house. The builder matters, doesn't it? When we, the builders, build by faith, when we build according to the divine blueprints, when we build in a way that is honest and fair, that is pleasing to the Master, when we build something that is dedicated to His purpose and to His glory, we're saying that the Lord is the one who did the building. The second conditional clause is not about building a house, but it's about guarding a city. And again, just like with working, He's not saying here that it's okay to be careless or indifferent in regard to security. He says, unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain. He's not saying, hey, look, the Lord's guarding the city. You don't even have to bother posting a guard during the night watch. If they fall asleep, you know what, it's no big deal. It'll be all right. Just like the building, security depends both on divine and human action. And thus, posting a guard, a sentry, and having him stay awake during his watch does make a difference. But it's not all that makes the difference. That human vigilance by itself doesn't guarantee the results. Now, in verse 2, we find what it's like to refuse to live with verse 1 in mind. And therefore, what it is like to live without the proper perspectives. It is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors. And again, don't misunderstand. There's hard work involved either way you go. There is one that is effective, and there's one kind of work that he describes here as vain, empty, futile, meaningless. Vanity, by the way, is a term that we're familiar with from the book of Ecclesiastes. There the point is being made in that book, that even though you may succeed in whatever you're looking to do, it's not going to provide you with meaning in life, because eventually you're going to die and you'll probably leave it to a fool. In Psalm 127, Solomon says here, you can plan carefully, you can work diligently, you can act responsibly, you can respond creatively, but if God's not involved, then all of those actions are delusional and deceptive. They're empty and ineffective, and therefore ultimately they are meaningless, they are vain, they are empty. But if God's not involved, it doesn't matter if you look to stretch the day. If you get up and you get started at the crack of dawn, literally here in the Hebrew, it's making early of rising. And it doesn't matter if you get up early and you work all day and you work late into the night, literally in the Hebrew, making late of sitting. The psalmist is telling us there's no point to working harder if you're not depending upon God. He's not saying there's no point at all in working hard. The Bible on numerous occasions, especially in the book of Proverbs, commends hard work. But you don't improve the building and you don't improve the guarding just by burning the candle at both ends. It's not just about working harder. It's about following the divine blueprints. It's not about having a Bible on your table, a picture of Jesus hanging in on the wall, offering a prayer before every meal, coming to every assembly that when the door is open. Solomon says it is about being a partner with God in everyday living. That last phrase there, the bread of painful labors, literally is eaters of bread of sorrows. It's not bread that's earned by hard work. He's reflecting a way of looking at life that labors with anxiety and toil just to be able to eat bread. But notice at the end of verse 2, there's this very stark contrast that he draws. For he gives to his beloved even in his sleep. Here's the flip side of what's just been stated. In the previous verses, there is this hectic and harried activity of human beings who are attempting to secure their own lives. And then side by side is this stark contrast, this image of sleep. And he's not talking about just, well, hard work is going to make you tired, and so you need rest. He's talking about something else here. In verse 1, he confessed that all human activity is meaningless unless God is actively involved. In verse 2, He confesses that toilsome life is likewise useless and vain, that it cannot and it does not secure one's life. Again, he's not diminishing hard work and effort. What he is doing is he is dismantling our assumption that hard work and extra hours of effort, that's all that you need in order to succeed. That's the American dream, isn't it? You work hard. You invest the time. You put forth the effort. And you can have it. You can have the dream. Here he reminds us that it's God's involvement in human life that brings success and satisfaction. But he uses a very different way to convey that truth. He gives to his beloved sleep, is how some versions render it, or as the New American Standard renders it, his beloved even in his sleep. You'll notice the three words "even in his" are italicized in the New American Standard. It's been added by the translators. The first way of rendering it would be saying that because of their trust in God, they have confidence and therefore they are able to relax and to sleep well. That because their life is in God's hands, things like anxious fear that would keep them awake, the fear of a meaningless life, those things have been erased and you can sleep well. The second possibility, that is that he gives in their sleep, would mean that they don't have to work so hard during the day. Because even while they're sleeping, God is continuing to give to them. He is active in his provision for them. Now, as a brief side note, there may actually be a hidden signature here from Solomon. His name that was given to him by God in 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 25 was Jedidiah, translated beloved of the Lord. And in 2 Kings chapter 3 and verse 5 and following, there we find the account of Solomon as God appears to him in a dream. That is, he doesn't have a vision. A vision takes place while you're awake. This is a dream. And so it is in Solomon's sleep that he is asked the question, "What would you want me to give to you?" And Solomon says, I want wisdom. It takes place while Solomon, in a sense, is asleep. And so that may be what he's referring to here at the end of verse 2. Beginning in verse 5, the writer shifts gears. And the word that appears in the New American Standard, the word "behold," translates a Hebrew word that signaled the start of a new direction of thought. And so he now moves from the perspective, the right perspective when it comes to building a house, to the right perspective that comes to building a home. And here the focus is not on the structure, but rather it is upon what takes place in the structure, in particular, children. And here we see a marvelous example of the provision of God in regard to a meaningful life in the form of children. Literally, this is, he says, "Behold, children are a gift of the Lord." Literally, it's sons, but in wisdom literature, this word was used to refer both to male and female on frequent occasions. He says, "Behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate." I want you to notice the terms that are used to describe them. There's four of them. The first one is gift. It's a word that means inheritance or heritage. And it's a word that is used frequently in the Old Testament to describe the land that was given to Israel. In fact, in the book of Joshua, it's used over 50 times in that particular way. He's not saying here that children inherit something from us, though that is likely the case, but rather we inherit them from God. That children aren't just born through human effort or natural processes, though it requires our participation. They're hardly the result of our strenuous effort. They're not earned. They're not merited. They are loaned. They are given in trust. In the ancient world of Israel, children were treasure. They were seen as a divine blessing, not a tiresome burden. Many today would tell you that they agree with that, but deep in the recesses of their mind, they are convinced that grandchildren are a divine reward for not killing your own offspring. The blessing of children looks a lot clearer in retrospect when you're a grandparent. And a lot clearer or a lot rosier in prospect before you have children than when you actually have children. It's a daily grind, isn't it? But the psalmist is looking to adjust our perspective of building a house, but also our perspective of building a home.
In the first section, he made the point that nothing that we do in terms of building can succeed apart from the active involvement of God in human life. Here he declares that because of God's active involvement in human life, that human beings can in fact be successful in the home. They are his gift, his inheritance to us. Second is an agricultural metaphor. He refers to them as fruit, and it underscores again the importance of God's hand as opposed to our performance. Fruit is the result of a process that is incredibly complex and intricate. We can't make it. We can't manufacture it. It's not the result of human imagination or ingenuity. No one produces fruit as a result of their own efforts. It is the natural product of a living thing. Fruit is what you get when there is life in the tree or life in the plant. And yet, even though we can't produce it, even though we can't cause it to grow, we can nurture it, we can care for it, we can cultivate it, but we can also neglect it as well. Beautiful fruit doesn't just happen. There was a time my dad owned about 10 acres of orange grove in Central Florida, and citrus is incredibly high maintenance. You have to do a lot just to keep it looking the way that people will buy it. There's a lot of work that went into it. And he put forth a lot of effort. And he finally realized that I'm not making any money on this. And so he just let it go, and he was going to come in, he was going to do something different on the property. But within a couple of years, I mean, that orange grove is, most of it's dead. It's when he stopped doing what he was doing, there was a dramatic change. He couldn't cause the fruit to grow. But when he stopped doing what he was doing before, it didn't take long before it just fell apart. Third is the reward. He says a reward. They are not just the result of a biological process, not just an interruption to your busy schedule, not just a tax deduction. They are a valuable reward. They are a payment. They are a recompense to us. Ancient Israel saw children as the greatest enrichment that God could possibly give to their lives. It's an image that stresses the joyful benefits that come from God. Remember, they lived especially in a world that where life was fragile, infant mortality was high. To have a child that lived and flourished was something that parents would praise God for. No devout person would ever neglect or abuse this rich gift from God. And then the fourth word that he uses to describe is an arrow. They are designed to be pointed at a specific target. If you've ever tried your hand at archery, you realize that it's a rather challenging skill to master. You can have a target the size of a king-size mattress, and if you're a novice, you'll be lucky to hit it. Because there's more involved than just sort of pointing something in the general direction and letting go of it. There is an art to learning how to bend the bow, how to take proper aim, how to correctly judge the distance and the direction and the strength of the wind. And the arrows have to be straight and not crooked if you hope to hit the target. And the word that's used here, it doesn't just say that they are arrows, but they are arrows in the hand of a warrior. They're in the hands of someone who has invested the time and expended the effort, who has exercised the discipline necessary to cultivate that skill. And therefore, the arrows in his hand aren't just used, they're used effectively. Gift, fruit, reward, arrows. Solomon says that's the children of one's youth. That's how they should be seen. And he adds the beatitude, blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. And the reason that he adds here at the end of verse 5, for they will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. I'm not talking about little kids at that point in time, are they? They're talking about what these kids will be able to do when the parent is older. The gate was oftentimes a place where justice was meted out, where there was commercial activity that took place, or legal disputes were settled. And Solomon here is not just telling us that the children are a good thing. He's wanting us to see the reason why, that it is an investment in the future. And thus he alters our perspective. He says children don't inherit. Parents do. Children don't get rewarded. Parents do. Children don't make us weak and old and exhausted. All right, maybe they do a little bit of that. Solomon says they make us ready for life. They equip us for battle. And again, there is this triangular relationship that Solomon builds in this
in this psalm between God and human beings and everyday life that extends to every facet of it. That whether we're a builder or a laborer or a guard or a parent, that if we're going to be successful, we are going to have to depend upon much more than just dedicated effort or vigilant attention or exhausting toil. Solomon says, look, unless God's involved, then all of that other stuff, whatever effort you put into it, it is going to be an exercise in vanity. But when you trust in Him, when He is part of the equation, when you trust Him to be at work in your life, then you can relax and sleep. The psalmist says God continues to give even then. That whether we're talking about work or whether we're talking about family, it is a matter of perspective. That when we acknowledge and when we submit to God's involvement in everyday life, we see life through His eyes, and in the process, we are equipped to truly discover life. Let me just share a couple of passages with you as we close from the book of John. Let's start first of all in John chapter 10 and verse 10 from the lips of Jesus. Jesus says in John 10 and verse 10, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they might have life and might have it abundantly. That's Jesus' purpose in coming. It wasn't just to save us from our sins. It wasn't just to deliver us from hell. It was to provide us with life, genuine life, that's real and meaningful. In John chapter 15 and verse 5, Jesus says, I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit, for apart from me you can do nothing. That's the message of Psalm 127. Apart from God, you can engage in all kinds of activity. But it's all vain. It's all meaningless. It's all empty. For it to have meaning, Jesus says you have to abide in me. Apart from me, you can't do anything. Connected to me as part of a branch of the vine, you can bear fruit in life. This morning as we close, are you connected to the vine? Are you connected to Jesus? Are you a part of Him? Are you focused on having the right perspective that sees life clearly? Not just Sunday, but life that takes place on Monday. Work, family. Are we seeing those things through the correct lens of God? And are we realizing that if He's not part of the equation, we're engaged in an exercise of futility? You need to be a Christian this morning. No better time to obey the gospel of Jesus than right now. We hope that you'll make that need known. Won't you? While together we stand.